Hello and welcome to the MMQB Thursday podcast, Friday edition. This is a very special episode. I am Gary Gramling. I'm always here, and I'm joined once again by Connor Orr. And Connor, we're going to do something a little bit offbeat because if we're being perfectly honest, everyone's been talking about the 49ers and the Chiefs for the past 4 days, and we'll be doing so for the next 9 days. So we're going to talk about the Super Bowl, but something a little offbeat here.
About it's a gambling PSA, basically. Yeah. It's a 30-minute gambling PSA for everybody.
It really is. We will go through the story, and hopefully you will all learn a valuable lesson by the time it's over. But we published a story online. If you haven't read it yet, maybe you want to read it. We will do our best to not completely spoil it. But if you go to SI.com, or you just, you want to Google it or whatnot, the headline is "The Deep End of the Pool." It was the strangest kidnapping case Western New York had ever seen, and it all tied back to a Super Bowl squares pool, an unexpected game, and the one man who got in over his head. But yeah, Connor, you spent a good 6 months. I sprinkled in here and there, but just sort of set this up, this kind of where this we started where it really took a turn.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a really fascinating story that kind of made regional news in that kind of Buffalo area when it happened. But this was last year during after the Patriots and Rams Super Bowl. And, basically, long story short, this is 40 minutes north of Buffalo, like right south of Lake Ontario. And one day, 2 o'clock snowstorm, like a regular weekday at a grocery store in the middle of this kind of really northern suburb of Buffalo. And, guys walking into the Tops Friendly Markets, and an employee and sees a truck with the window rolled down, someone screaming for help, kind of peeks in and calls the cops. And the next thing you know, an officer is opening the door and cutting rope off the person's neck, duct tape off of his ankles and his hands. And the person says, "I've been kidnapped." And so we have a full-blown kidnapping investigation in the middle of snowy Western New York in the winter, which is like, that would be like a cop chasing criminals on ice skates, basically, anywhere else in the continental United States.
No, it's and this is kind of like the picture your favorite police procedural. This is when your New York City cops like show up in the very small burg with the small town cops, and they're like, "We don't get crimes like this around here," type of thing. And they got it there, and we're off in this kidnapping case. But he mentions to the cops, this all ties back to a Super Bowl squares pool, of all things, a Super Bowl squares pool that you probably all do at the office.
That's what was so like, I want to be careful with my words here because, there is an element of humor to this story, but obviously, like, it is a moment that, significantly altered people's lives. But I think that one of the funny things about it is it's a Super Bowl squares pool. And a lot of times when you think about people being mugged or kidnapped for money or, anything like that, it is like hardcore gambling, right? Like a spread. You're betting against the spread, or you're doing something, Vegas-y. This is a Super Bowl squares pool is what you play at your friend's house when you go to watch the game at his place. And, it's just sort of more of a party game than anything to kind of keep people interested in the score, especially if it's a blowout at the end of the game. So it was just sort of a strange thing that, you compare that to any of the other sort of gambling related kidnapping injury stories that we've heard throughout modern history. And this one is more like, it's like the equivalent of maybe getting like kidnapped for a game of pin the tail on the donkey or something like that. It's like a very like it's kind of weird.
Super Bowl Squares is definitely not a game of skill. As someone who hosts the MMQB Gambling Podcast, I would point out that you know, if you do it right, you can make some money. I wouldn't recommend it trying it because I don't know, unless you listen to our podcast every week. But you know, Super Bowl Squares, you're plopping your name on a in a square, and for those who don't know, basically you get the grid. It's 10 by 10. One Super Bowl participant gets the rows, one gets the columns. You have 100 squares because 0 through 9 is going to be the second digit of every score during the game. But basically, you have 100 squares. You buy a square. You put your name in it. And then once all the squares are filled, the person who runs the pool randomly selects the numbers that will be assigned to each square, each row, each column. And then the winners are the ones that, in a typical squares pool, after each quarter, the second digit or the only digit of each team score. So last year, for instance, the score at the end of the first quarter was Patriots 3. Nope, it was scoreless. It was 0-0. So the person at Rams 0 and Patriots 0, wherever that corresponds to on the square, has won some sort of money. And then you go on, and the person who has the final score typically gets more. Now, let's talk a little bit about this guy, because we do say this is more a game of chance. This is more a lottery than a game of skill here. But this was a big money school, big money pool. The gentleman's name is Robert Brandel. He is a 6-year-old employee of a Specialty Fibers. They make sort of like fiberglass insulation for cars and that sort of thing. A company called Unifrax up in Tonawanda, New York. But Robert Brandel's pool, $500 per square for a Super Bowl Squares pool.
Yeah, so I think that was the draw, and certainly why we probably heard about this story in the first place, right? And we should mention that, you know, it made the viral news rounds when it was initially happened. It was on Saturday Night Live. It was on Weekend Update when the story kind of got fleshed out. But yeah, so I think the cost of the buy-in of the pool is significant here, because, you know, most of the time you're going to go over to your friend's house and put down, like, you're going to buy a square for anywhere from $10 to $20. Mm-hmm. But this was $500 a square, and so, you know, there's 100 squares, and so right off the bat, you know, the total cash is north of $50,000, because not only was there you know, just the baseline, I'm going to sell all these squares, but then there was a lot of side games. You know, if you had matching numbers, if you had squares that touched the squares of the winners, if you had all these other like little side props and side bets. So this was a really like, you know, it was a big money pool, and there are people in any, you know, any place I've ever gone, right? You know, there's the people who like to have fun with a little bit of money, and then there's the people who are like looking around and saying, okay, where's the real stuff? And this was the real game at the office. I mean, as someone told us, it's, you know, you don't find a $500 squares pool, you know, anywhere. And so it was attractive. And, you know, some people split them with friends, you know, two or three ways. Husband and wives, family and friends, they would kind of all chip in to get a slice of this. So, I mean, there was a lot of cash floating around. And, you know, if you consider, you know, really for anybody, and, you know, I think that there's probably maybe some James Holzhauer type gambling people who are listening and saying, ah, you know, I blow that in an afternoon. But if you think about the average, you know, American family, I mean, you know, you win in this pool, and this is it changes your year. Maybe you go on a vacation, you pay off some student loan debt. I mean, you know, you could buy a new car, and this was a really big deal, I think, for some people.
So the Squares pool has been completed here at Unifrax, and you have a lot of Unifrax workers, but you also have some names, some nicknames that are said to be from a local bar that Robert Brandel had frequented. We had things like Stretch, the Twins, my personal favorite, Boner, and
Batman.
Yep. Didn't Batman have a last initial, if I remember correctly? Because it's like an elementary school, and there's two kids in the class, and there were maybe two Batmans in this pool.
Yeah, it's like Hannah B and Hannah A from The Bachelor. But there was also one like Grimmer, and I didn't know if like that one might have actually been someone's last name, but it just made me think of Grimace from McDonald's, and I was like wondering if he was thinking about Grimace from McDonald's, or you know, if that was just something that, you know, it's my own personal longing for Grimace from McDonald's. Maybe that's getting in the way of it.
Yeah, I mean, he always, if you read the MMQB very closely, you will see some sort of homage to Grimace in just about every story, and that's that'll be the one in this one. But so the Unifrax folks are all told, these are some folks from a local bar, they're doing it with you. And this was not a new pool. This was the eighth year he ran it.
Eighth year. Mm-hmm.
And people who won, you know, got their money. That there was never a problem in the past.
Yeah. I mean, this was, you know, and everyone loved him there at work. I mean, he was the guy who would pick up the shifts, the guy who would bring in candy for everybody, the guy who would pick up your tab at the bar. And so, it was ideal. I mean, he is the person that you would want to jump into one of these pools with, because you're like, yeah, that's one of the good guys at work. I mean, you know, what could go wrong? And I think that, you know, you all know those people at work, right? I mean, there's certainly like, you know, if I were to walk into the office and Gary would ask me for $500 to start a pool, there's no way I would do that. And there's 0% chance. But, you know, if somebody else, you'd be like, yeah, that looks like a guy I could hand over $500 to. And he was that guy. He was the person that you would trust and you would hand it to. And he would collect the day after the previous year's Super Bowl. He would do payment plans. So you could give him $20 a week for however many weeks, and you could pay it in installments, and he would write everything down. And so everything seemed like super copacetic. I mean, the pool had a long history, a backstory, you know, people who knew what was going on. So, you know, it all seemed to work out.
So the game begins, Rams Patriots, and look, we're coming off not only a season of high scoring games, but the previous year, Super Bowl 52, you had a high scoring game between the Eagles and the Patriots. Everyone's expecting all these points, and of course, as we all know now, the Brian Flores, Bill Belichick defense completely befuddles Jared Goff. Wade Phillips does the same thing to Josh McDaniels and Tom Brady in the Patriots unit. So you get this defensive slog, really tense game, but shockingly low scoring. So as we mentioned, you know, you had a scoreless first quarter, so the person who wins a prize there is the 0-0 square. You had a field goal, a Gostkowski field goal in the second quarter, so 3-0 wins the second quarter. And then the Rams, of course, drive in the third quarter, and everyone remembers that that play where Brandon Cooks is open in the back of the end zone, and Jared Goff just a little bit late with the throw, a little bit too much air under it, and Jason McCourty just makes it back there to deflect it. Rams settle for a field goal. It is 3-3 after three quarters, so that, you know, that 3-3 square has won the third quarter. And then it gets weird, because you have the Patriots go down. They finally, you know, a couple of Gronkowski passes. Sony Michel ends up with a 2-yard touchdown plunge. And then they, after a Gilmore interception, they get the ball back. And they take it down, long, time-consuming drive, run after run after run, and they end up kicking a field goal. So they make it 13-3. So now all of a sudden that 3-3 square is once again set up to win. The Rams take it down. It's you know, it's 72 seconds left when they get the ball back. They have 10 seconds to go. They have it at the Patriots 30, and they do the old, you know, the logical thing. They're going to try and kick the field goal. Then they're going to try and recover an onside kick, and then they are going to try a Hail Mary pass. It's a desperation scenario, but if you are sitting on the 3-6 square, the Patriots 3, Rams 6 square, this is excellent news for you. And then, of course, Greg Zuerlein pulls the kick wide left. All that's left is a Brady kneel down, and that 3-3 square ends up cashing in for the third quarter and for the fourth quarter. And in Brandel's pool, he also had a payout for the quote-unquote reverse of the final. So if it was 13-6, you would have paid out 3-6, but you also would have had a prize for 6-3 because it was 3-3, one of these matching squares. That basically, among some other prizes, also gets the reverse score. So this person with the 3-3 square is in for a huge payout. And I should mention, I won't say the name for tax purposes, but a friend of a friend of a friend who was at Atlanta for this game in a $1,000 squares pool had the 3-3 pool and is a also a huge Patriots fan, and he was literally like tears of joy as Greg Zuerlein's kick sailed wide left. But Brandel's pool, this is big money for the 3-3 winner.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at least from our calculations and what we had heard, you know, $22,000. And again, I mean, that is the entire pool. You know, he would pass out a flyer to everyone at work sort of advertising the pool. And this was $10,000 more than the entire pool had paid out the year before. And so this was like, you know, this would be like at your office if, you know, everybody's playing the Powerball together and then all of a sudden somebody hits it. And I think it's one of those like really like eye-opening things where it's like, wow, this is actually going to happen here. And I think it's exciting, right? I mean, you know, $22,000, any of us, you know, hopefully our podcast niche is the people who can get excited about $22,000 like I can. If we're appealing to the 1%, then we need to better advertising deal on this podcast, I think. But, you know.
I know, some luxury products, some Williams Sonoma type stuff coming in.
Yeah. If I would have won $22,000, I would have like, you know, I definitely would have like kicked the door in at Sports Illustrated and been like, see you never, suckers, I'm out of here, you know. I think that was the vibe. It's like, you know, you could do, you know, how many times in life can you go out and just go to like a really like a nice car lot and just be like, yep, here it is. Mm-hmm. Give it to me, you know, or whatever you want, you know, or book any vacation you want. And I think that was like the energy that was going on from the person who won it. But there were a lot of people that walked away with a decent chunk of change from that game too.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, just to be clear, $22,000, that is exciting money. That and that's not when you went in a gambling pool, you probably don't want to just put it in the bank. You do want to go out and spend it. And so, you know, we'll fast forward a little bit. We're 3 weeks later, and Brandel has stopped going to work. There are people who have not been paid. He hasn't paid out any money for this year's pool. And again, this is the eighth year running it. The previous 7 years, everyone who won got paid. And all of a sudden, he's not at work. He hasn't paid anyone. He is, you know, there's some arrangements to make payments, and he sort of is coming up with a series of increasingly bizarre sort of last-minute excuses to sort of bail on paying it. So at one point, you have a couple of his coworkers who are winners in this pool. They just go to his house.
Yeah, I think that was sort of the turning point of this story where you know, he's coming home, and, you know, I think very, you know, at this point, probably clear that something has happened to the money because it's becoming increasingly difficult for the people to get it. And they feel that, and, you know, coming home, turns around the corner and sees the truck there with everyone from work waiting for him, and just speeds away and he's gone. And, you know, this is not one of those neighborhoods, you know, if anyone's kind of driven up there, this is not Southern America, Dukes of Hazzard, where you can have these amazing road races, you know, kind of in, you know, it's a nice, you know, suburban neighborhood. You know, it's a very like, and it's not one of those things where you could have a good old-fashioned car chase. So if you knew your way around the place, you could escape. And that's what happened. And all of a sudden this went from, you know, maybe he was on vacation to, you know, maybe he's, you know, something happened and, you know, maybe he extended his vacation to this dude's gone, like in the wind. And he knows we know, and nobody knew what was going to happen next.
Yeah. And I mean, look, it's First of all, it's lovely country up there. If you don't like the snow, you don't.
It is beautiful.
Yeah, you don't like it up there if you don't like the snow. But it's just sort of a lovely suburban kind of town. I mean, I've been up there a couple of times in my life. We went up there for reporting on the story, but I've been up there. I've been to the TNT rivalry game. That's Tonawanda versus North Tonawanda up there. It's a nice little sort of a slice of Americana type of town there. Comfortable place to live. But yeah, he has now disappeared, and it's been like 48 hours since that collection. And I mean, these people at work, there are jokes, but then the jokes aren't so funny anymore because it's kind of like, oh, maybe we're not getting that money that we were in line for here, or, you know. And at one point, there was a rumor that one of his Brandel's family members had reported him missing. Some people were trying to look him up. They thought maybe he had property elsewhere. Had he smashed his phone and run, and he was hiding out? And nobody knows where the guy is.
It's just so weird because you would never expect that to happen, right? Like, all of a sudden, you know, everyone wants their work life and their home life separate, and nobody wants to carry, you know, there are very few people who probably love being at the office more than they do at home, or love the people that are at the office more than the people are at home. And it was probably such a weird, like, blurring of lines moment for everybody where, you know, this is, you know, you probably get home and your wife is like, hey, where's, you know, didn't we win $20,000, you know, or, you know, or your family's like, hey, you know, didn't we win all this money? Where is it? And, you know, you're thinking about, oh, well, can I book these flights to Disney World with my kids? You know, can I tell this guy at the car dealership that I want this truck? And all of a sudden, like, you know, as Biggie Smalls said, more money, more problems. And that was Notorious B.I.G., right? He was more money, more problems, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. No, yes. I'll say that with confidence now. I had to run through the Rolodex of music I listened to in college. And yes.
You're Notorious B.I.G.
I shouldn't say that I listened to in college, that others listened to in college. So therefore I listened to I did not care for Puff Daddy and his associates.
Gary was the one. Gary in his dorm room was just blasting Pavement and saying, turn down that crap. I want to listen to Dinosaur Jr. in here.
It was a real, it was Pavement, but also I was like a grumpy old man. So yeah,
it was perfect. Yeah, no, it was just, I would say, like, for the, I've talked to some people because the story ran today and we're recording it the night that it ran. And, you know, for the people who kind of breeze through it, and, you know, our ability to be shocked is our threshold for shock is very high now, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I read 5 stories today from other magazines that just completely blew my mind from a perspective of, like, I can't believe somebody would do that. But I think with this one, you know, you need to readjust your perception a little bit and just say, like, think about how weird it would be on a very, like, personal level, you know, and not like, you know, nobody is like stealing the Mona Lisa, you know, but somebody is like, you know, it would be like the craziest thing that happened at your office by far. You know, think about all the weirdest things that have happened at your office in the last 10 years, and this would be definitely weirder than that.
It's we'll get into the motive in just a second, but he turns up 48 hours later, and now this is when we are in the Topps grocery store parking lot up in the hamlet of Wright's Corner.
It's a hamlet.
It is. We learned, but I always thought hamlet was just another word for town because there are a bunch of hamlets up there. And no, it's within a town. It's actually within it. It's part in Newfane and part in Lockport, if I remember correctly. Just I really want to make sure everyone has the visual correct. Picture Newfane and Lockport, and then a hamlet within them. That's Wright's Corner.
Yeah, it's like it's the middle of the Venn diagram of those two towns.
Yes.
Basically.
Oh, that's a really good visual right there.
I liked. You know what? We were up there and driving around there. It is so peaceful, and I was there in the summer, and I was there in the winter, and you know, it's just like one of those cool, like, you know, like American centers of town, right? There's the ice cream store and the liquor store, the grocery store, the McDonald's. But then there's like the little diners and like everybody's got Buffalo Bills flags out and like, you know, the library. And I don't know, it's like it was just like a really chill place that I can imagine like spending a weekend if you wanted to get away somewhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But here he is on a February day, and the cops show up. He is he's in the back of the car. They sort of set him free. He is shaking as they put him in the back of the cruiser, and they're going to try and figure out what happened here. The officers are thinking like we're going to have to, this is going to be an all out blitz here. We're going to have to get investigators from a couple towns over. We need a forensics team. I mean, we're going to have to go all out here. But not everything quite added up, and that sort of very early on made itself evident.
Yeah, and you know, the police department, you know, I guess we'll say thanks to them too, just for, you know, opening their doors and, you know, letting us kind of go through everything and have them walk through everything step by step. And you know, it definitely gave me a different appreciation for the interrogation process, mostly because I'm a big Law and Order SVU fan, and all Elliot Stabler does is like intimidate people. He just screams at everybody, and he has like assaulted more criminals than the criminals on the show. And so you're like, there's no tactics here. I mean, it's like, this is what cops do. That's crazy. But you know, the officer, the first responder on the scene, officer by the name of James Moscato, is like he's a decorated police officer. And you know, he gets there, and this guy is tied to the headrest of his truck, and he's duct tape bound together. He's screaming. You know, it's pouring snow outside, and you know, I just have to imagine what my mental state would be when I go in there, and here he is sitting there listening to the story. And every time, you know, he gets a little bit of the story, he's writing stuff down. He's saying, "Well, this doesn't seem right. This doesn't seem right." And like the duality that you'd have to develop in your mind is incredible. Like if you had come kicked in the door of my house and said, "Connor, I've just been kidnapped, and here's 10 things that are going crazy with my life right now," I wouldn't be sitting there going, "Huh, you know, Gary looks like he shaved recently, and you know, his clothes look pretty clean, and you know, and but this is what the cop was doing." By the time, you know, he's not only thinking about all the resources that he needs to bring in, the video team, all the second, third units, but also like, you know, hey, here's why we're going to be skeptical, but also here's why we got to hear this guy out in case there's two kidnappers on the loose. So it gave me definitely a different level of respect for like how much information you have to take in, you know, and you know, in a crazy situation like that.
Yeah. So they I'll just run through Moscato's sort of checklist that he shared with you. Basically, he looked at the truck and no accumulation of food wrappers. Brandle had said they were driving around for a couple of days. There's no accumulation of food wrappers or anything like that, or receipts or tobacco spit that would make you think that more than one person had been in that car for a while. Perhaps they were just very, very clean kidnappers. Brandle's, like you said, Brandle's clothes were clean, his pants were dry. Kidnappers typically don't, if you're gonna nab a guy for $16,000, which is what Brandle said they stole from him, and steal his truck and basically commit a series of felonies, you're probably not courteous enough to do a lot of bathroom breaks and whatnot. And his goatee was pretty clean shaven, which is not how you... It's just not how you look after a couple of days.
Yeah, and I think the most amazing part was, you know, to try to put yourself there for the conversation where, you know, and this is, again, something that I never would have thought to ask, you know, if I was a cop, is that, so the window's rolled down and he's screaming for help out the window. And the cop says, you know, "Well, when the people dropped you off here and left you there, did they roll down the window?" And then, you know, "Because you need the keys to put the keys in the ignition to roll down the window." And that was like, you know, I'm sitting there going like, I never would have thought of that. Mm-hmm. And he asked him that, and he said, "Well, no, you know, I had to reach into my pocket and plug the keys into the ignition, turn the car on, roll the window down, yell for help, and then take the keys back out of the ignition. And so, you know, this is when they're about to send him down the road to the investigator to get a better, you know, idea of who these kidnappers are. And they're going to start really kicking this thing into high gear. And this cop's thinking, well, he had the keys in the ignition of the car. Like, why didn't he just leave? You know, like, why didn't he just run away? And I think that that was like a big moment for them, where it was like, okay, we might not be arresting kidnappers. We might be arresting someone for filing a false police report.
Yeah. So they get to the station. It's Investigator John Sparrow is going to be conducting the interview here, and it just unraveled really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine like the worst, you know, I mean, we've all tried to lie, you know, we've all tried to get out of things, and it just wasn't rehearsed, you know, the story mm-hmm. wasn't rehearsed. And, you know, cops will, you know, another thing that I learned during this process is that cops have ways of picking you apart that you don't even realize. You know, they're looking at not only what you're saying, because they can tape record what you're saying, but they're looking at what you're doing, where your eyes are moving, how you're positioning your body. I learned that, you know, when I interviewed the investigator for this story, he joked, like, some of this stuff I probably shouldn't be telling you in case you plan on committing a crime, you know, because, you know, you might actually get away with it. But, you know, if you're like kind of holding your elbows, or if you're doing anything like that, it's called a guarded position, where you're, you know, subconsciously soothing yourself because you know that, you know, you're in some kind of internal danger. You know, if you're sweating, especially in February in Buffalo, you know, that's sort of an indicator. If you're rocking back and forth, if you're not maintaining eye contact, you know, all these things that you don't think of, you know, when you're talking to a police officer, they're just running through the stuff in the back of their head. And then on the front end, they're hitting you with all the questions. So they Mirandize you. They want you to tell your full story. And then they go back line by line by line, and they pick it apart. And it's like, well, you said the gun was silver, and then this time you said the gun is black. And you said that you drove to this town first, and now you're saying you drove here. And, you know, it's incredible that, you know, it took about 14 minutes in interrogation before they were 100% positive that this was it. You know, I mean, this was a filing a false police report. There were no other kidnappers. This was a guy at the end of his rope who just thought that the best way out was to basically make the money look like it had been stolen from him.
Phony kidnapping. I mean, it's incredible that it ended up in this place. And we'll talk about, we reached out to Robert Brandel. He texted back and forth with you a little bit, Connor, but he did not want to talk for this story, for, you know, understandable. He would like to move on.
Sure,
with his life after what had gone down. But, he's in fairly deep trouble here. I mean, he is going to be arrested. There's no doubt about that. I guess what, to me at least, one of the absurd things, and you know, you spoke to his lawyer, and his lawyer was just kind of like, you know, part of the punishment for Brandel was going to be a restitution aspect. He was going to have to return money to you know, pool participants' satisfaction, and you know, there's obviously a $1,000 fine, there was community service, and you know, he just figured, like, boy, he's going to do all this stuff, but at least he's not going to jail. And then of course last August he is sentenced to 15 days.
Yeah, I mean, that was surprising to me for a few reasons, just because, you know, the case had been initially put on, you know, it was something that you know, our editor Adam Duerson was like, hey, you know, keep an eye on this, because this, you know, something might happen here. And so you know, started kind of looking into it when we were at training camp in Buffalo, and just sort of peeking around. This is before he was sentenced, and you know, I was thinking, man, you know, filing a false police report in the middle of the winter in Buffalo, and just if you think about the resource allocation alone, you know, if you do that in a lot of places, you have to pay for all of the services that are redirected to you, you know, and whether it's paying monetarily or you know, with your crime, with your jail time. And so I was thinking, like, this is like a 2-year, 3-year, 4-year sentence, like minimum. And it was 15 days. And his legal team was surprised at 15 days in jail. They were like, this is crazy. They had said that, you know, why are you turning the district attorney's office basically into a bookmaking service? Because, you know, if you enter into these pools, it's not a legally binding contract. I mean, you're flying by the seat of your pants and you're hoping that the person pays, but you don't know. I mean, you could be dealing with whoever. And so he's like, this, you know, this isn't a legally binding thing that they're entering into. Why are we taking it this seriously? And, you know, it is an interesting sort of like counterbalance to that, right? Because you think about all the people who made the money and, you know, were expecting the money, and it was a lot of money. And then there's the other side of it that's like, yeah, this was like an office game. And sometimes, you know, shit goes haywire, you know, and it's not like any of us signed a contract, you know, it's not like ADP is, you know, controlling the pay scale here and that they're getting everything in on time. It's like, hey, you know, you're taking a risk. I mean, you're throwing your money into something that you're really not sure what's going to happen with.
So, I mean, look, the closest thing to a legally binding contract with his pool was when he had to go around with I guess like a little spiral notebook and get people to basically sign on saying they're satisfied with their restitution.
Yeah. I mean, that was it. I mean, and here's what really amazed me about this story, because this is kind of, we took it from, you know, people had known about the arrest. I don't think they knew anything really about the investigation. They really didn't know any of the background, but then this was the other component to it. He did pay every single person back, or, you know, there were some people that, you know, had to take it or leave it. But everybody got at least the entry fee back and their winnings. And then, you know, the people who won the big prizes, right, you know, ended up having to settle for less, which is disappointing, but nobody lost money theoretically. Like, if you think about it, if you'd already spent the money, then you lost money because you're getting less than you thought you would. But I mean, had to go around and scrape the money together and literally pay off everybody, which is wild. I mean, and probably a difficult thing to do, but props in a way, right? I mean, I would have never gone back to that place again. I just would have probably skipped town for good.
Yeah. And I mean, look, that again, that's a $50,000 pool. And what we don't know, because again, Brandel wouldn't talk to us about it, but we don't know what happened to the money. He obviously didn't have it because he didn't pay people, and then he eventually did get his hands on enough money to pay, you know, to pay off most of the $50,000. But we don't know if he, you know, basically collected this money and just uses sort of a personal piggy bank. And but what we do know is that the bar that was supposedly also a part of this was not a thing. There was, I regret to inform everyone, there was no boner.
R.I.P. Boner. We hardly knew ye.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, I mean, it's just it's a wild thing. One thing we forgot to discuss, which I think was probably my favorite part of the story, and we'll kind of back up a little bit to the investigator's room, is that during this like life-altering moment, one of the cops does make like a Fargo joke, you know?
Yeah.
Makes a joke from the movie Fargo, and he says something about, you know, burying your cell phone under snow, and that you'd have to put an ice pick into the snow so that we'd know where the cell phone was. Because in the story, in the kidnappee's story, you know, his cell phone was thrown out by the kidnappers, right? And so, yeah, he made like a little Fargo joke, like a Steve Buscemi joke. And it's like, you know, it possibly is a way to lighten the mood, because I do think the cops, you know, and they did. They told us that they felt bad for him, you know, and that they're probably just trying to make a joke at that point to sort of bring some levity to the situation. But, you know, probably didn't land at that point when this person just found out that they were getting arrested and, you know, having a really difficult time with it.
But yeah, we asked two of the participants to look at the board and say, how many names do you recognize? And the answers, one answer was 37, the other was 40. So we're looking at more than half of the squares being faked. our theory, at least this is what I landed on, Connor, and if you have sort of thought this over and want to, I don't know, branch off and have your own little theory on this, but he didn't have the money to back 60 purchases at $500 a piece, but he probably just looked at it and said, like, well, I got 60 squares, so maybe I'll go a little bit into the red. I have a decent chance of winning some of this money. And look, it's probably, his odds are not good. He is not playing the pot odds correctly if he does this, but I guess it's kind of the same thing as going to a casino and playing a little, you know, blackjack or craps or whatever it might be. The odds are against you, but you're probably looking at this and saying, like, ah, you got a 40% chance of making a little money here.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you did not draw the squares at random, and even if you did, you know, we had this guy, Anthony Zanfrelli, who was with the Harvard Sports Analysis Collective. I'm going to botch that, and I'm going to get destroyed by a bunch of, you know, really powerful people.
But you have the boorish manners of a Yalie, Connor.
But they went back and they, you know, as a project for the kind of the blog that they're running off of their Sports Analysis Collective, you know, they made a heat map of all the squares that you'd want, you know, the most, the squares that hit the most, you know, the percentages, and they do all that kind of stuff. And, you know, when we explained the scheme to him, you know, he was basically like, you know, what you would do is you would operate it like a casino. Like, even if you were drawing them at random, you have house odds, right? So you're slated to win 60-40 or whatever it is, you know, and so you just treat it like that, where, you know, you run the game and maybe 5 out of the first 6 years you win, and you just keep a little bit of that money just in case somebody hits a jackpot. And in this case, somebody hit the jackpot, but it, for whatever reason, there just wasn't that slush fund to, you know, tied everybody over. And unfortunately, you know, that led to a really weird place. And, you know, it was, I got to thinking about that a lot, right? You know, and like what leads you to make that decision, right?
It's, yeah,
like the first thing I'm thinking of is, you know, and a lot of people, when they first heard this story, were like, oh my God, you know, why? You know, and I wouldn't have done that, but you just don't know, right? I mean, I don't think a lot of us have been compressed to that point in our lives where, like, you know, we've had to make that decision where it's like, and all of a sudden, like, this idea just hits you with a, like a bolt of lightning, and you're like, yep, this is it, and there's no choice, and I've got to do it now, you know?
Now, it's like the scenario that he is probably playing out in his head is the best case scenario is, you know, there's a brief police investigation, and he says, like, oh, you know, I don't even want to press charges. Like, I'm just bummed that the money's gone, and then it just sort of goes cold, and everyone moves on with their lives, and no one's going to blame the guy for having $60,000 stolen from him. But I don't know. I'm just saying, if it was me, if I was in that spot, I'd probably come up with a story that was, like, less of a horrible crime. I'd say, like, oh, I had in a bag somewhere and went to the bathroom. Some dude swiped it and ran or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd like to think so, but, you know, have you ever been in a situation where, you know, in proportion, obviously not to this magnitude, but, like, where your back's against the wall and you just start operating in a way and you're like, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? Yeah. You know, and your mind is saying, like, this isn't the right thing to do. Stop doing this. But it just, it happens, you know? It's like almost like this inertia that you can't control. And maybe that was it, where it was just like, you know, it was bits and pieces of these ideas that you had. And, you know, I mean, in hindsight, would we have all just probably taken out a loan? Yeah. Or would we have gone to work and said, hey, you know, I did this and please don't tell on me. I'm just going to need like another 6 months to get my, you know what, together. And I'm going to make it up to you, but I just don't have it right now. You know, any of those things probably would have been preferable, but, you know, maybe, you know, we'll all reach that point in our lives where, like, you have this one chance and, you know, you take that one in a million shot and hope that it pays off, you know?
And I think what's sort of so hard to reconcile with this is, and I'm not going to say this guy was, you know, a clergyman or anything, but The most obvious way to fix this thing would be to not do the random number assignment to the pool, to tip the odds in your favor, to give yourself, and if he had done that, I mean, number one, we had people who participated in the pool who told us they were absolutely confident that the drawing was random. There was another colleague who witnessed it, and everyone was satisfied that it was a random drawing. But that makes sense, because if you were going to fix it, you would give yourself one of the 3-3 squares and the 0-0 square and the 7-0 square and all the squares that were most likely to hit.
Yeah. I mean, in just a quick Google search would bring you to the Harvard Sports Analysis Collective's pool. I mean, you could run that thing straight from their guidelines, and you could stick people with, you know, they did 30 years of research, and there was like 7 or 8 squares that had never hit, ever. There's a 0% chance of them hitting, you know? And so, I mean, based on the research timetable. And so you could stick everybody, all the real people with those squares, and you'd be living large. You know, I mean, that would be, it's the perfect crime, really. You know, if it works out that way, right?
Yeah.
If it works out the way you think it is.
You are cheating all your colleagues. So that's not, right. Yeah. That's not cool. But, yeah, I mean, look, Connor, when we start on the story, I kind of, was really excited to find out what this, because a lot of people referred to it as a scam and a scheme, and obviously the phony kidnapping was, but the pool itself, yes, he didn't back it with money, but I thought there would be some like spreadsheet jockey type of stuff. I thought this was like I don't know, maybe this guy was like hanging out with Sashi Brown and getting some ideas about how to somehow tip this in his favor or to play it perfectly. But it just seems like a guy who just, you know, he didn't do the math at all. And maybe this just you know, a lot of people think who he spoke to said they think he's been doing, which it certainly adds up, they think he's been doing fake squares for a while, that he's been sort of buying out the rest of these squares without paying or whatever it might be. But it worked out for him the past 7 years, whether he won money or obviously didn't lose this sum of money. But there was no real, it seemed like just a really bad gambler.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's kind of the lingering question that we were left with, right? Is like, brilliant person who the drawing really wasn't random, and just the people that we had talked to were misled or didn't know, and he was rigging this properly and just had one bad year, or it was 7 years of incredibly good luck, or it was, you know, or this was the first time that he actually decided to do it, or it was, you know, maybe a slow addition of actual bodies to the pool that tipped the odds and kind of came back to bite him. But I mean, I think it's safe to say it was one of those scenarios. But you know, it's crazy how, you know, that fine line between like an actual brilliant crime and something where you end up sort of in this situation, right, where you find yourself having to cover your tracks for something that, you know, you could have been fine. You could have run it like the guy said, you could have run it like a casino.
Well, Spiro asked him one more time on the way out, and this is really the last word, as far as we know, that Robert Brandel has said on the subject.
He said, "Once I was in, I was in. You know, there was no turning back." And I think that, you know, that kind of maybe sums up his state of mind. And I'll tell you what else it sums up is when I asked Gary to come with me to Buffalo. It was like a random, like a Tuesday, I think, I want to say, or like a Wednesday. And we both left our houses. We live in different states, but probably about equal proximity to Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And we both left our houses after dinner, which was, in hindsight, just a totally insane thing to do. And figured we would drive all night and meet in Buffalo at like 1 o'clock in the morning. And then we got destroyed by just an insane amount of snowfall. This was like either very early November, right? Like very early, like, or like maybe mid-November.
Yeah, I remember driving up, the 49ers Seahawks Monday night game was on. So it was, I don't think that helps anyone nail the date down. I shouldn't have said that, but that's my memory of the first part of the drive, and then the second part of the drive. And we both went to Syracuse, so we're, this didn't catch us necessarily off guard, but the roads were absolutely horrendous, and I could not make it to Buffalo. I had to stop in Rochester.
Yeah, I felt so bad because I like rented this big SUV and we were going to meet in Binghamton, and then we just ended up not meeting in Binghamton, and we were like, ah, it's going to be fine. And then probably about 45 minutes outside of Buffalo, like the skies just opened and there were semi trucks all parked on the side of the road. And I just, you know, I was in a giant Infiniti SUV and I was just like gliding down the road, and not in a pleasant way, like a sort of like an unsure ice skater kind of way. And, you know, I'd be in one lane one minute, one lane the other. I'd be like sideways, diagonal. And I felt bad because you didn't have nearly the kind of horsepower at your disposal at that point.
Don't underestimate the 2007 Saturn Aura. I had borrowed that car from my father. That is not my Saturns are fine cars. That is not the car I usually drive. But I was like, you know what? If I'm going to put a couple hundred miles in a car, I might as well drive this one that's not mine up there. And boy, did I pay for it!
Blew out a tire.
I did. I made it to Rochester and got up early the next morning to meet Connor in Buffalo, and blew a flat tire on the thruway, and did not have the equipment to change it myself, and then had to wait for AAA to show up. And it was we made it to our first appointment just in time by some sort of Tonawanda miracle. But boy, that was a trip.
That was miraculous, because I remember hearing from you that you were at like an auto body shop an hour south of where we were supposed to have an appointment. And then, you know, so you were like 32 minutes away. And so it was like 32 minutes down, 32 minutes back. We're not going to make it. And we like miraculously pulled up like exactly on time. And I just remember thinking like, wow, like that is like one of the very rare times that that works out. And I felt really bad because I was like, nope, I'm coming to get you, Gary. Like,
yeah.
You're coming with me, and then we'll figure out what's happening to the car. But I'm gonna have you riding shotgun for this. So.
And look, I mean, we were meeting a source, so if we were 10 minutes late, was he gonna stay around?
Gonna be there?
I don't know.
Find yourselves an editor like Gary, people. That's the moral of this story. I still owe him a tire.
I only went because I really like that area of the country. And I like Connor. And we got some beef on Weck later that night, so it all ended up very well.
Buffalo's finest delicacy. Maybe more so than the wings. I mean, I love wings, but I would say I'm more regularly in the mood for a beef on Weck than wings.
My thing about wings, there's no sustenance to it. It's like chewing gum. Like, it's just like it's getting the taste in your mouth, but it's not like it's not filling you up. It's not powering my day in any way, shape, or form. Not like a beef on Weck.
That said, I did go to Bar Bill's during Buffalo Bills training camp, and Bar Bill's and Buffalo Bills have nothing to do with one another. And got some wings and some waffle fries there, and a Big Ditch Brewing Company IPA, and that was about as close to like a religious food experience as I've probably ever had in my life. Like I was sitting there at the bar and I just kept being like, holy shit, this is amazing. Like, everything is perfect. And I tweeted that, and a lot of Buffaloians really appreciated that. So that was good. I felt good that I picked the right place to eat the wings. I picked the right beer. I picked, you know, all the right things to do, which I very rarely do. Most of the time I just eat at Jimmy John's wherever I go.
No, it's anyone who's listened to me on these podcasts over the years know I have a soft spot for the Buffalo Bills, and I have a soft spot for the Buffalo area. It's an incredibly underrated part of the country, and yeah, you should head on up there, hang out in North Tonawanda for a day or two, and see how you like it. I think you'll like it a lot.
It was not a bad spot. I mean, you know, some people get sent to the Caribbean to cover prize fights or to track down Rex Ryan on vacation after he gets a Mark Sanchez tattoo. And and some people get sent to Tonawanda. And I'll take being the Tonawanda guy 10 times out of 10.
Oh, man. This one was a lot of fun. And like I said, I mean, look, we ran through the story. It is... Connor won't say it, so I'll just say it on his behalf. It is wonderfully written. It is beautifully written. The headline is "The Deep End of the Pool." It is the story of the most bizarre kidnapping case in Western New York and the Super Bowl Squares pool, and quite frankly, the missed field goal that led to it all. Connor, thanks for being on. We have plenty of Super Bowl Chiefs 49ers work to do in the next week, but I love this story, and I'm glad we got to talk about it.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. Thanks for your help. Thanks for sacrificing the Saturn, and I'm gonna pour one out for the Saturn. It was good. It's a good car.
The Saturn still lives. It's just. Yeah, I didn't put the wheel cover back on, but it's sitting in front of my house right now.
Battle scars.
Oh, yeah. The MMQB Thursday podcast is me, Gary Gramling. Special thanks to Connor Orr, this week's guest. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.